Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday. It is the 4th of March, the first Monday of March, and we are thrilled to have you with us for our excursion in broadcasting over the next hour. We will talk about a lot of things. We have a wonderful panel to do it with. Let me introduce everybody. Mike Spain is here. He is the newly retired associate editor of the Times Union, and so retired and so newly retired that he was away last week doing what retired people do, travel.
That's right.
Is 6 not working? Should I put him on 5? Okay, I'm going to put you on 5 there.
Oh, there. Okay.
No, it is 6? No, 6 is okay.
Okay.
All right, we got 6.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, there you go. Go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Thanks
yes, right.
I traveled. Engineering stuff.
We went down, my wife and I went down to Mexico. A good family friend was getting married there, and then we went on to Guatemala and El Salvador, and they're beautiful, beautiful countries. Big green volcanoes that one we saw in Guatemala that's even been active in the last year. Little puffs of smoke coming out of it still. So
very cool.
Yeah, just fascinating.
Well, we're glad you're back. We're glad you had a good time, and thank you very much for being with us. Sarah Rogerson joins us as well. She's an Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm doing well, thank you.
Wonderful to have you here. Dan Arizari joins us as well. He is chairman of Capital District Latinos. And Dan, it's been a little while since you've been here. Good to have you back.
Always good to be back.
Yeah, where have you been?
I have been, culturally engage or culturally empowering and community engaging, which we do at the center.
That comes before being on the roundtable.
No, I shouldn't say that.
No, you have some cool stuff coming up. Do you want to tell us about that now, or would you like to tell us about that later?
Well, I could tell you quickly about
okay.
it now. On Friday, we have a big reception, which we're doing in conjunction with the Somos el Futuro Conference, which is the Puerto Rican Hispanic Legislative Conference.
Yes. Wouldn't miss it.
And between 2 and 4, we're holding forth. We're having my niece, who I am especially proud of, who just won a place in, I think it's the Spolstra Music Festival in South Carolina. She's a violinist.
Wow.
She's going to be playing. We have a beautiful art exhibit by a Puerto Rican artist by the name of Roxana Melendez, who is... You know, we have an exhibition space, Alan, because you haven't been. I have to explain this to you.
I walk past it all the time.
So we have to get you in.
Have to go in.
Yes. And so from 2 to 4 on Friday, we have this fabulous reception. And it's the first time, and I'm proud to say this, that Somos el Futuro has had something off campus. So we're calling it Somos Goes Uptown. And Uptown is 160 Central Avenue, the Cultural Empowerment and Community Engagement Center. So you're all welcome.
Very quickly, though, the name Somos el Futuro. Mm-hmm. What's the intended message?
Well, I think it is a moment when all types of Latinos come and converge on the Capitol and talk with their legislators and discuss the agenda. The intent has always been to affect the budget, New York State budget.
Gotcha.
And so the idea is to hold a show of force wherein Latinos from all over the state and actually nationally also converge on the Capitol and say, we are here, these are our needs, and this is our message.
Is this separate from the Black and Latino conference that we have just gone through that received a little bit of criticism?
That is correct. It is a separation that occurred back in the 80s. There's a famous fallout. I won't go into detail, but
really?
I'm sure you know some of it.
No, actually.
You
don't?
Well, we can talk off-air about it.
One of my favorite things about Somos is that it also includes a component where young people get to be involved, sort of like a mock state legislature where students from all over the state of New York converge on the Capitol and learn about, you know, civics, which we keep talking about isn't taught enough in school, on the ground, in the Capitol. They're bussed in. And there's also a lot of scholarships that are handed out, many, many, many scholarships.
And it's very powerful.
As opposed to what I was just referring to. With the conference where scholarships were supposed to be handed out and weren't.
Well, that's a separate nonprofit,
which is
separate from the caucus. Yeah. But yeah, yep.
But it is, as Sarah just pointed out, that mock legislative session is something to behold because you have these brilliant young people who are civically engaged, who are making arguments, and I think some of our legislators might learn something actually by watching these sessions, which they do actually. So, but thank you.
Excellent. Well, a lot going on. We thank you very much for being with us, as always, and thank you for sharing the great work that you're doing, that you're all doing in the community. Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
We're okay. Joe, my brother-in-law, Roselle's brother, passed this weekend, and it was a downer. And she had invested a tremendous amount.
Oh, boy.
In taking care of him.
And so sorry.
So this was a tough time. Look, I only mention it because there are a lot of people who go through this, and the sociology of death and dying is an incredibly important subject, which we probably should be paying more attention to.
I agree with that.
Absolutely. Thoughts to the family, and thank you very much for being here this morning. Let us go through what we have going on today. We have a lot to talk about, and we will get going. I would like to begin with the emergency declaration. You will remember that the president called for about 2 weeks ago. Now, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky is throwing his support behind the resolution that would block the declaration of a national emergency to build his long-promised wall, defying a warning from the president, getting the measure and putting the measure on track to passage. It may put it over the edge. Paul, in a speech on Saturday at the Southern Kentucky Lincoln Day dinner, said he can't vote to give extra constitutional powers to the president. "I can't vote to give the president the power to spend money that hasn't been appropriated by Congress," Paul said. "We may want more money for border security, but Congress didn't authorize it. If we take away those checks and balances, it's a dangerous thing." He joins Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and Tom Tillis of North Carolina in opposing Trump's move, a reflection of some resistance within the GOP to what lawmakers see as an executive overreach and a test of the constitutional separation of powers. What do we make of this?
Well, now the president is really in a rough spot because he will, of course, veto the resolution, but it looks like the line is drawn even more inseparably between the president and the Congress. You had to look no further than this insane, and that's the only word I can use, address that he gave to the conservatives this weekend, where he just ranted and
2 hours and 19 minutes.
He went off script, you know. He went off script.
I don't think he was ever on script, right? I mean, that was the thing, right? He was never on script.
I think he needs a script.
Well, it depends. To me, a guy who acts this way and who has been so irrational in all his behavior, he just adds to the fact that there are so many people in this country who are saying, uh-oh. Because as one commentator said this weekend, remember, folks, this guy who was really acting wacko in the speech, he's got his finger on the button.
Well, right. Well, this might be an indication that, there's others. Lamar Alexander is not so happy, and he said it publicly about, you know, Senator Alexander said he wasn't happy about the president's emergency declaration. And there's others in the Senate, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, who have questioned whether that's the right idea. And if it does get to the Senate, and when it does get, when it absolutely will get to the Senate, it looks like it will pass, and then the president will have to exercise veto power for the first time. And, you know, maybe by then, I don't know what the timing of that vote is, but maybe by then some of these other things that are starting to dribble out will have some Republican senators thinking, you know, maybe it's time to kind of cut it off with this guy and show our independence, because we're going to face re-election in 2 years or a year and a half. And maybe this is the beginning of that kind of shift where Republicans are actually paying attention to the democracy and the Constitution.
Nothing brings fiscal conservatives to the yard like the spending power. And that's what this particular fight is all about. Maybe we found the magic wedge between Republicans in Congress and the president, because it gives them cover. They can go out while they're competing in their own midterms and say, look, we've stuck to our fiscal conservative guns. We're making sure that we rein in this president who doesn't quite understand our values when it comes to fiscal conservatism. It keeps him out of identity politics. They don't have to talk about immigration. It's kind of a magic issue for them. And I wasn't at all surprised to see Rand Paul's name at the top of the list this week.
Do you think anyone's? Do you think anyone will be added as a sense of is this, that it will gain momentum and more senators coming forward now
well,
that
it,
you
it kind of looks that way. I mean, you know, there's three or four others that are kind of leaning now to vote for the resolution that says that. Says the emergency declaration doesn't hold,
but it's a long way to an override.
It is. Yeah. How many votes, Alan? Does they need to override?
Well, they need.
The veto?
I'm sorry. I'm.
Yes.
I'm unprepared, Professor. But you know,
I think the veto-proof majority is a supermajority.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So it's 67 only.
67. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's still a few more, but you know, momentum. That's what
well,
it's about.
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, the Republican base shows no signs of deserting Trump at all. Every poll is showing that they're right up there. They haven't moved a bit off. And when it comes to a primary, they know what will happen to them. So the real question to me has always been, will there be some courage? Will there be profile and courage? What is it really worth to be a stand-up who says, I'm not going to take this, I won't do it?
Well, not that this isn't a hugely important issue because it involves the Constitution, separation of powers and all that. But here we are, we've been talking about this every day. And he keeps, you know, talking about the wall. And what aren't we talking about? We aren't talking about the 13,000 children who are in captivity. We aren't talking about, excuse me, the 4,000 plus likely rapes or molestations of children in these camps. We aren't talking about climate change, even though 24 people or more just were killed by tornadoes in Alabama. We aren't talking about any of these really earth-shattering, you know, for lack of a better term, and momentous issues, because we're talking about the wall, which is what Trump wants to talk about. So I think we're losing in this case. I mean, forums like this where people are actually critically thinking about things are important, but he is at the center stage. And look what he did. I know we're jumping ahead, but look what happened at CPAC. That hideous spectacle of him hugging the flag while at the same time trying to abrogate everything that that flag stands for in so many different ways. What do we do with that?
You know, when you're... Well, never mind.
On that note, let me drop that.
Well done.
When you're a star, you can do that. You can
fill in the blank.
You can just grab a flag and
grab them
right by the stars and stripes. Well, so a lot of these stories intersect, but one of the ones that we have on the docket today as well is that you have two issues. One is that a lot of senators are caught between speaking out. This is Democrats, obviously, of staying in the Senate and actually kind of running the show versus running for president, which is an issue. But the other issue too is that I have to bring up the quote. But the senators who say, look, we realize that staying with this guy is dangerous. You know, this could come back to haunt us, but what else do we have right now? And I think that's interesting.
Well, it's all about their political survival. At what point do they figure they're better departing from him or it's safer to be with him? And that's a calculation that I think is going on for every politician that is so far stuck behind the president.
Well, it's a game of chicken to the extent that there are any people who are thinking of primarying this president, assuming he's still in office around the time that those decisions are going to be made. They know he has enough power to cut them off at the knees or whatever the metaphor is, right? So they can't. It's a little bit of gamesmanship, and unfortunately, as you mentioned, it's the American people and children who are paying the cost in the meantime. And because those voices aren't as powerful, and because those voices aren't as loud, and because those voices are systemically silenced, that they're not a part of the conversation. There'll be a conversation, a part of the conversation when it's too late and we start enacting laws in retrospect a decade from now saying we should never let this happen again.
Yeah. I mean, that is a conversation I think that many of us are having now as to even now of how have we let the last 2 years take place and what do we do?
But there's a counter narrative, and that is, and that's what he, and we'll talk about it, I guess, with CPAC, but the, I mean, there is some, you know, some traction to the notion that the Democrats are have been upset since the election was lost in 2016, and they've been doing everything they can to undermine this president. And every time he comes up with anything, they, you know, they come up with new things all the time, and they're trying to reverse the election that the American people made a decision. And that carries some weight with his constituency, and that's how they look at it. They don't look at anything else. They don't look at the merits of what's going on here. They don't look that the Constitution has been undermined. They don't look at the horrible things that are happening on the border. They don't look at any of that. They don't look at the farmers that are getting slaughtered by these tariffs. They look at it black and white, or you know, right and left, or you know, red and blue, and they're with him on it because they think that he's being, you know, just attacked.
Well, and wins and losses. Yeah. So he thinks that he won on executive power because of the Supreme Court's ruling in the Muslim ban case. But he lacks the sophistication necessary to understand how distinguishable that case was from this issue of spending power and the border wall.
But you know, Sarah, as somebody who is so conversant with all of these issues, it has to be very frightening to you that this anti-immigrant, anti-other approach has so much traction, so many legs.
It is, and what's even more terrifying is when we're out in the community speaking with like-minded pro-immigrant folks, actually, the lack of understanding in some of the language and rhetoric used, even by people who purport to support the movement and to support immigrants in our community. That's how deep these exclusive and xenophobic notions are in the bedrock of our society.
We're going to pause there, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll include letters. We welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org.
Sarah.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have just about 25 minutes left at 10 o'clock. We are going to take a quick break, and then Governor Andrew Cuomo will join Alan Chartok in a discussion from 10:05 to 10:25. So we will do that. But first we have letters, and then we'll move on to some other topics. As I said, a lot of our topics are oozing into each other, so we will we'll start to tick them off and talk about some of them in a little more detail in just a moment.
Good morning, roundtable panel. I am not a physician, but I believe that Trump was definitely under the influence of a mind-altering substance during his horrifying rally speech that went over for over 2 hours.
See, I'm afraid he's not.
Hubris? is hubris a drug?
This is what it is.
This may just be the baseline. Go ahead.
He showed himself to be incoherent and unhinged. Grabbing the flag and hugging it was a frightening display of someone not in his right mind. What do we do? And that's Irene from Cambridge.
Wasn't the first time he's hugged the flag. I've seen, I think at campaign rallies he did that too.
Well, I think what made this one a little bit different is the length. It was 2 hours. It was
more than 2 hours.
Yeah. 2 hours and
oh,
what did I say?
Oh,
2 hours
yeah.
And
oh,
21
diatribe,
minutes, 18
yeah.
minutes or whatever it was. And also it was profanity laden. It was going after Mueller. It was going after Jeff Sessions. He led the crowd in a chant of "Lock her up." It was like a greatest hits rally. It was very strange.
It's like going to one of those concerts at Proctor's where they bring back all the early 60s, you know, Motown and everything.
And there's only like three original members
right, yeah.
out of 12. Yeah. Yeah.
To me, it was more like Nuremberg. That's
yeah,
what
I was going to say
yeah.
brown shirts more
yeah.
like it.
Well, it's really scary. Two things about it that I'll just quickly say. One is that I tried to find a really good article. I did find one, but of the day of, there was a lot written about it. Yesterday, finding anything about it in the paper was virtually impossible. And it's as if it didn't happen. And I think that's dangerous because mm-hmm. it did happen, and it was really frightening.
But you
and,
know, Joe,
and I understand people can't. A lot of people can't stand it and don't want to look at it. But boy, I think it's important that people see some of that.
I think your point is well taken about what he talked about. It was almost as if we were watching a psychoanalytic session in which he's telling the shrink all of his problems. They said this about me and they said that about me. And, you know, it defies what a lot of people will tell you in politics, which is you never repeat the lie. So if you really think somebody's lying about you, you don't say it. But he said it again and again and again. I think he is scared to death about the Mueller report and what's coming. After all, let's keep our eye on the prize here. The Mueller report is being written by a Republican. A Republican who, you know, like Comey was a Republican, like each of these people are. So this business is of changing fact. The fact pattern is unbelievable to me.
A Republican, by the way, who is really patriotic, not faux patriotic, who actually went to service, who actually has spent years uncovering crimes and prosecuting them.
Mark says, "Dear panel, any chance the Weld candidacy could have an impact?" And that's from Mark. Well, not right now, but you never know. Look, Weld was my governor. I thought he was terrific. He saved the WAMC, which makes, which gives me a fond, he gives him a fond place in my heart when some misguided environmentalists tried to take it down the station from the top of Mount Greylock. He said, no, he's got a terrific sense of humor. We're going to paint it green, and we're going to put a big green bow around it. As far as I was concerned, good enough. Look, anything can happen to Trump, and if it does, and if there is an impeachment effort, or if he has to resign for one reason or another, then a Weld could be a very good candidate.
Do you think you'll see more Republicans come forward to try to fill that space?
Without doubt.
Right. I don't know how many sitting office holders will step forward. That you know, Weld has sort of been a somewhat of an insurgent. He ran ran briefly for governor of New York, and then he ran for president as a libertarian, I think.
Correct.
Back, you know, he might hurt him. It might look like he's just sort of a
seeker.
But won't it be positive at least that there's somebody in the Republican Party who's actually saying
No. There's others, I'm sure. Yeah.
Well, right now he's the first one who stepped forward. Right. Well, there's another fellow, right? Out in the Midwest, Republican who's...
Well, I mean, don't you think John Kasich might consider a candidacy?
We assume Kasich. Yeah. Flake has been mentioned, so...
Right.
You can make the Kasich. That was... Jack says, Trump's CPAC speech. Dear panel, Donald Trump delivered a speech from the heart. At the CPAC convention. For 2 hours, he rendered the least wholesome, most egregious speech ever by an American president. His disrespectful flag hug kicked it off, and it went downhill from there. Of course, it landed on a thrilled audience, proving that Hillary had it right. A basket of deplorables. And that's Jack from Ghent.
Well, the New York Times did do a fact check on it, and they found 15 major things that he just completely got wrong. All backed up by their research, you know, and they show how that is. But it doesn't really matter when you're speaking to that crowd how accurate you are. It's just a familiar recitation of some of the old tropes that got him elected.
And in fact, Mike, if you think about it for a moment, I think that the people in that audience know he's a liar, and they like it. Like it is the point.
It's political theater.
Yeah.
He's doing exactly what he gained popularity doing, which is going on TV and making bombastic statements and making examples out of people and issues. And all of this really is about him. We know this. This is why his calendar is that he wakes up in the morning and stays in the residence until 11 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes
executive
the afternoon, watching cable news television in order to get validation. So it's also actually a really tragic, sad display of his desperate need for attention, and he knew he would get it there. It filled his bucket.
Okay, so let's talk, and at the risk of going into the psychoanalyst here, but the fact, let's even take content away from it for a moment. The fact that there is not a coherent thought that is communicated, that there is not an ability to be able to complete a thought or a sentence or a pattern and bring an idea home, shouldn't that alone be concerning?
What do you mean, shouldn't?
Well, of course.
He would see that as a sign of success, though, right? It's a win in his book if he can do it in 6 words. You know, several punchlines, several potent potables.
Right. Well, those are easy to chant and easy to remember.
And if you can turn on the bass, you can get
that stuff.
But
I'm just talking about words coming. I mean, word salad is the phrase is used so often. But it's just
I love that, by the way.
When you read the transcript, you
Russian dressing,
understand it. You do not know. I defy anyone to understand what the hell he's talking about.
I knew what he was talking about.
I know. As I said, politics aside, but I'm just saying. As far as for 2.5
continuity
hours,
wasn't
exactly.
In that right. And he did kind of look like Humphrey Bogart in the Caine Mutiny to me.
He did,
but he is degrading the conversation that we're having.
Well, that's so easy for you as a liberal and as a progressive to say he's degrading it, but not according to the way that guy's mind works. He's talking to those people who are in that CPAC hall, who are the basis of his group. Who have not moved a whit.
Religious conservatives are the people that he was speaking to by and large. And by the way, there was a 16-foot picture of him displayed, and people were taking selfies with that in the background. Picture that, right? And then there was somebody who introduced him, I don't know, some CPAC member, who said that Jesus had anointed Donald Trump for this moment. So I want you to think about that for a minute. Well, now you're bringing God into this equation, and now you're telling people who are desperate, you know, throughout like the Rust Belt and the South and people who are impoverished and whose kids are on opioids, and now you're saying this man
was sent by
is
God.
Anointed by God to help us to make America great again.
And CPAC kind of has taken over the party. I mean, they're leading, the Republican Party.
And I continue to insist that Democrats have to take back some of that language that he and his cohorts are using. Because when you think about 14,000 children locked up in the desert, okay?
Yeah, that's much higher than they ever acknowledged, but government documents show that it's that high.
So when you're talking about that, how can you not draw parallels in your religious mind to, dare I say, the children of Israel in the desert wandering because of what Pharaoh did to them. Mm-hmm. So I'm just riffing here, but what I'm saying is we have to take back this language.
And yet it's
man.
Coherent and it has a point. Just saying.
When you say really quickly, but when you say
wait,
I know. But when you say CPAC, you know what's interesting? The analysis is that it ain't the same CPAC that it once was.
No,
there was conservative political thought that was going on.
Right.
This is now Trump thought.
Right. There's no conservatism about it.
Yeah. It's been hijacked. Yeah.
When we come back, I want to talk about the New York Times story about the nightmare of sexual violence on the border. Talk about that story, which is quite hideous. And we will finish up with your letters as well. The governor of New York State will join Alan at 10:05 this morning. So we've got about 15 minutes left. We will continue our conversation right after this short break. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Dan Irizarry, Sarah Rogerson, and Mike Spain making up the panel. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan, you have a few letters, and
yes,
then we will move on to some other stuff.
Yes, I do, Joe, but if I have to find them here.
They're in your suit.
Okay, this is from Joel, who says, "Good morning. We all know how Alan feels about impeachment. Do not impeach unless the Senate has the votes to convict. But what about a resolution of censure? Cohen's lawyer, Lonnie Davis, has called upon the House to do just that. The conservative Weekly Standard has also urged the Senate to censure Trump." Well, good luck, Charlie, on the conservative Weekly Standard telling the Senate to do it. But the House, it's a good idea. Why not? It's a good preparation. I encourage it. Anybody else on that? No?
And how does that figure into what Jerry Nadler is doing?
Jerry Nadler is outright saying that this guy's an obstructionist and he has tried to, and he has broken the law. And
he wants to launch a probe of Trump's abuse of power. He is making very clear what you have said all along, Alan, that he doesn't want to talk about impeachment, and it's a long way off, but he does want to start to look at that abuse of power and to start bringing
obstruction
the,
of justice was also in
correct.
That. Yeah.
And start bringing the
that was the term
together.
I was looking for, Mike.
Right. That's so familiar. You want to hear Peter Rodino saying it about Nixon, and then you hear, and you hear Jerry Nadler, a well-known here in Albany, of course, from his time in the Assembly.
And well-known on the west side of Manhattan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so Mike says, CPAC and McCain. It is sad that the delegates at the CPAC convention cheered when Donald Trump talked about the death of John McCain. I guess Republicans have totally surrendered to the personality of Trump. I find it ironic that Donald, when he was in Hanoi, showed no desire or curiosity of visiting the infamous Hanoi Hilton. I have yet to see any evidence that Donald has shown a desire to visit the Vietnam Memorial. Kind of a pathetic for a man who professes, in quotes, love for the military, and that's from Mike of Glens Falls.
Well, there are a lot of other Republicans besides the CPAC people. I mean, there's a long history of Republicans who compromise with Democrats who've made, and those are the people that have been quiet that probably should be goaded into stepping forward and just handing over the party to CPAC.
All right, so there is the story that I alluded to before our break in the New York Times this morning, the front page. You have to pay with your body, the hidden nightmare of sexual violence on the border. I will skip the preamble and go to the fourth paragraph of the New York Times story that says, on America's southern border, migrant women and girls are the victims of sexual assaults that most go unreported, uninvestigated, and unprosecuted. Even as women around the world are speaking out against sexual misconduct, migrant women on the border live in the shadows of the Me Too movement. The article goes on to say the stories are many and yet all too similar. Undocumented women making their way into American border towns have been beaten for disobeying smugglers, impregnated by strangers, coerced into prostitution, shackled to beds and trees, and in at least a handful of cases, bound with duct tape, rope, or handcuffs. The New York Times found dozens of documented cases through interviews with law enforcement officials, prosecutors, federal judges, and immigrant advocates around the country in a review of police reports and court records in Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. The review showed more than 100 documented reports of sexual assault of undocumented women along the border in the past two decades. So it's important to look at this, Sarah, and say this is not a recent problem.
Definitely not. And it follows a similar pattern. And it's a natural evolution of the deep and rapid militarization of the border. When that happens, and when we fail to treat the border zone as a community, and when we start looking at it as a military zone, and when we staff that zone not with trained law enforcement officers, but with a civilian, for lack of a better term, command force that's completely untrained in how to protect women and children from domestic violence or to secure anything at all, this is the natural conclusion of those actions. It's not that it's been happening all along. That would be a mistake. You know, people keep saying this has always been the case. What's the big deal? It's happening at ridiculously high rates on our watch, and it's completely preventable.
And there's also, I think Sarah could speak to this better than I could, but there's also been a change in the demographic of the people who are leaving and trying to gain entrance at the border, right? So once upon a time, it was men looking to work here in the United States because they could send right. money back home. Now you're talking about families, which includes women and includes children at a higher rate, I believe, than what used to be the case. So then you do have, quite logically, the increased danger of sexual abuse. And here's the crazy thing about it. Trump, you know, went on about duct tape and all this other stuff. And now, and the media went like, oh, there's no duct tape, there's no duct tape. Okay, so we find out that there is some duct tape. Of course, you know, how else do you tie people up, right, in the modern era? Duct tape. But what's lost in that is the need for a coherent immigration policy, which we don't have. So what is the answer? Is the answer a wall? No. How about immigration reform? Isn't that the answer? Isn't it more likely that will solve issues like slavery?
Well, we should go to Sarah because Sarah is the expert. Go ahead.
You're correct about the shifting demographic at the border. This government doesn't care about comprehensive immigration reform, and it very much is not concerned with the price of their policy being borne by black and brown women bodies. That is something across this administration that has been evidenced, whether it is mass incarceration and the way that women are treated while they're incarcerated. There was another report that came out last week from this pro-life party that the Department of Homeland Security did not consider a stillborn child born in captivity to be considered a loss of life. Wow. At what point do we hold this party accountable? It's not even an immigration policy at this point. It's just pure hate. Mm. And borne out, again, on the bodies of black and brown women and children. And we don't care. And there's no one to raise the voice and say, it's not even in the shadows of the Me Too movement. It's not included in the Me Too movement. It's not a part of that movement yet. And I'm not faulting the leaders of that campaign. They have a lot of work to do. There's a lot of this going on. But now that we're confronted with these reports, hopefully litigation will reveal additional information underlying this abuse. Much of it will never be seen because it hasn't been documented or captured. But now that we know about it, we have a moral obligation to do something about it. And for those of you who are not immigration lawyers, the best thing you can do is raise your voice in every outlet possible and show these women and these children that we care about them.
And you do that by how?
Write letters to the editor, write op-eds, put together silent protests, talk to your church, your faith communities. There are lots of faith communities who are up in arms over this. Work through your social concerns committees or whatever your committee structure is at your church to decide to take a public stand about this. We have a First Amendment right. We have a right in every community across this country to stand up, and especially white folks who have so much privilege and who will never face or will rarely face the prospect of arrest as a result of speaking out. It's our duty and our obligation, if we're moved by this, especially as Christians, to speak out against this practice.
And I think there's also, just in general, when you're talking about this atmosphere that we're living in, there is a very real local connection to this, too. And not so much the sexual assault part of it, but the idea of people being scared to come forth now that the census is about to take place in a couple of years. And I mean, the chilling effect that all this conversation has on people is going to have a real impact on the amount of resources that municipalities like Albany and other places where there's a large immigrant community, whether or not they get the resources they need to improve their lives. And that is something that if you can't really grasp the significance of the larger, you know, writ large issue, take a look at the local issue and try to do something about that.
We just have about 2 minutes left. Alan, you had a few letters. We'll end with
those. We do. We had one. We had two from people who said, don't shorten the panel by having the governor on anymore. I'd like to know what they would do if one was really unkind, said I was doing it in order to stroke my ego. But one wonders, what would you do if you were the news director, you Ian Pickus or Joe Donahue? And the governor of the state was going to come on and talk to you, and you were going to make news across the whole country as a result of that. Would you really say to the governor, no, we don't want you? Would you really say that? I don't think so. So keep your hate to yourself. Gordon says Trump's speech resembles a speech by a cult leader. Trump's rambling two-hour speech reminded me of the rambling many-hour speeches I used to listen to when I was a member of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon's Unification Church. People in that position know, luckily, they could say anything or do anything, and the audience will assume there's some good reason for it. Luckily, I left the Unification Church. How can America leave the Trump cult? And that's from Gordon.
Deprogramming.
Julius. I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you could lead the way.
He actually served jail time, right?
Didn't he? Sung Myung?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he did. It was a big deal.
Julia says it's going to get worse. Panel, the CPAC debacle is only a sign of things to come as the 2020 campaign gets into full swing and the rat-in-chief finds himself deeper in the corner. Pardon me. Beware of the violence against opponents he will encourage, and that's from Julius.
Alan, we're out of time. We've got to run. My thanks to everybody, Alan, Dan, Sarah, and Mike. We'll be back with the Alan and the governor, who I believe is with us now. So we will we'll skip. We'll have a break, and we'll have a quick underwriting break, and we'll come right back with Alan and Governor Andrew Cuomo right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. And Dr. Alan Chartok speaking with the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo. Good morning, Governor, and the rest of the day to yourself. And good morning, and good morning, Alan.
And good morning, Governor. It's great to have you with us. We very much appreciate this valuable time. Okay, so let me start by saying, Governor, the budget talks broke down over the weekend because you and the legislature have different revenue projections for the coming year. Now, I've been around for a long time. As you know, I'm an old man. And one of the things that I have seen again and again and again is the legislature wants to spend more money, and the governor and usually the controller find themselves in a position of having to hold things down. That's a question.
Yes. I didn't actually hear the question, but I hear the tone. The question is in the tone. This is a different environment politically, and it's a different legislature. I've done a number of budgets with success, Alan, but you're exactly right. The first question, especially this year, is the revenue forecast and the numbers. I am proud that we've done budgets on time. I'm more proud that the budgets have been right. People forget. You can do a budget that gets passed, but then turns out to be inaccurate, and then you have to come back and readjust because the revenues or the expenses didn't work. So on time is important. Being right is more important. And legislatures like to spend. It's the Italian grandmother that food is a proxy for love. Eat, eat, eat. The legislature just won elections. They want to go back to those groups and say, here's more, here's more, here's more. The problem is we're in a fiscal environment where we have less and less and less. I am telling you, this SALT Trump tax reform is hurting the state. We've seen a $2 billion drop in revenues already, and I'm not doing an irresponsible budget. And they signaled that when they have higher revenue forecasts than myself, I believe it's going to be higher than the controller. We had an economic forecasting conference where all the independent economic forecasters came in and said this economy is slowing down. So we have to be responsible on the numbers. And on time would be nice, but being right is essential. And I'm not going to do a budget that I know is not going to stand up to the test of time. It's not even smart for the legislature to want that budget. Yes, they want to give out a lot of goodies, but there's economic reality. And this budget has to have a middle-class tax cut. I believe that, especially in light of SALT. We have to have a permanent property tax cap, because when people take that big property tax hit this year from SALT, I at least want to be able to say, well, stay with us on the state side. We have a 2% cap. We have to fund the MTA. That has to be done. They don't want to do it one way. Then we have to do it with fair increases. And we have to reform the criminal justice system. Those things have to happen. I think they make a big mistake if they don't do marijuana in the budget, because I think they're going to be in trouble if they don't get marijuana done by the budget. I think it's a mistake to leave it for afterwards.
So,
I've said it.
So why don't they want that, Governor? Why don't they want the marijuana?
It's difficult and it's controversial. That's why I say do it in the budget. See, the budget is a point in time, Doctor, that requires people to make tough decisions. And left to our own devices, we don't want to make a tough decision. Let's be honest, especially a legislator, right? Yeah. Legislator who does nothing wrong. Why should I make a tough choice? I'd rather not. The budget says you have to make a tough choice. Once you get past the budget, then you can go back into debating dialogue mode. But I think if they don't get marijuana done in the budget, you're going to see real trouble on it, and they're making a mistake.
And what's the real trouble?
I don't think they get it done.
Oh,
and
I
they've
see.
Already signaled that they want to do it after the budget. And I said at that time, it's a mistake. But permanent property tax cap, criminal justice reform, funding of the MTA, we have to get done. And we have to have a budget that's a real budget and matches up with the numbers. And I'm not going to do a budget that doesn't.
And what's the consequences, Governor, if they don't do this? I remember during the great pay debate, whether they got pay or not, one of the things that was attached to the agreement at the time, I don't know if it still is they don't get paid their salary, their increased salary. They have to give that up if they can't come to agreement. Is that wrong?
No, you're right. We said in the law, not in the pay commission, we said in the law last year that set up the pay commission that it had been a long period of time without a pay raise, about 17 years, but frankly, not many of the legislators were there for 17 years. But we said it would be performance-based. And the performance for the legislature, the one benchmark is get the budget done by April 1. Now, everybody says, well, the legislature won't get paid. Yeah, what they leave out is the executive doesn't get its raise either. And I've hired a lot of commissioners on the promise of the new increases. So not getting it on time is a double-edged sword. The legislature says, I don't even know that some of them read the law. I spoke to one member over the weekend who didn't even know the executive didn't get paid. He thought it was just the legislature that didn't get the increase. But it's both. The legislature doesn't get the increase, and the executive doesn't get the increase. And look, I have no problem saying to the people of the state, if they get their job done, they deserve a raise. And if we don't, neither of us deserve the raise.
Yeah, but you don't have to worry. Chris will loan you some money, because as you said in the last time we spoke, he makes a lot.
He makes a lot, and I'm not spending that much. But my commissioners... Look, we have commissioners.
I got it. We got it. We got it. We got that part. We got that part.
Okay.
Let's go to Comptroller DiNapoli. He has to establish the state revenue estimate. Are you in touch with him?
No. Yes, I talked to him. But I have not spoken to him about the revenue estimate. The way the law works, though, you're right. If we don't come up with a consensus, which we didn't, then it goes to the controller. The controller picks the revenue estimate. My guess is the controller, who will not be motivated by politics, you know, why do they inflate the revenue estimate? Because they want to spend more. So they want to project that the revenue is going to be higher, because whatever they project in revenue is what you can spend. And look, I like to spend too, right? There's a lot of good things that we can do. But I want to make sure that we have the actual revenue to back up the forecast. The controller doesn't have that political concern. And the controller sat there in the forecasting conference and heard every independent expert come in and say 40% chance of a recession. You know, so I would be shocked if he didn't come in with a realistic option.
Well, I'm a big fan of his, but he does have a horse in the race, right? I mean, in other words, controllers by nature should always be conservative, because if that's outspent, somebody's going to be pointing a finger at him and say, we didn't raise what you said we would.
Well, that's the interesting dynamic here, is because it's now going to be his number and his responsibility. And if that doesn't turn out to be the reality, you're right. It's the burden is on him. Normally, in the years past, we've come to a consensus forecast. So if it didn't turn out to be accurate, it was the legislature, it was the governor. But now it will be the controller's number. So my guess is you're right. He's going to want a realistic number because right or wrong, everyone's going to know.
So, okay, so I have a lot of things I want to talk to you about, and we only have a few more minutes, you know, 15 minutes or so. So I want to ask you very quickly, there's a New Atlantic Magazine article about you and suggests that you would like to run if VP Biden doesn't run for president. And the article said, if, but you didn't totally rule it out. There are a lot of people, Governor, there are reports all over the place that, you know, despite your past assertions that you would serve out your term and you wouldn't do it, that you are looking to run for president.
Who said that, Alan? Give me the name. I will call them up. I will call them right now.
I just gave you one.
Look, we live our lives on a set of assumptions and a set of realities. I have a set of assumptions as to who is going to run and what that means for the country and what this Democratic election is going to look like. I think it's essential that the Democrats win. I am frightened out of my shoes about President Trump.
Sure.
And I think the Democrats should win unless the Democrats blow it. And I believe the Democrats are capable of blowing it. So I think I've had conversations with people, obviously, and I think certain people are going to get into the race. And I'm basing my assumptions
certain
on
certain people
that.
You mean Biden, right? So in the end, doesn't it come down to Biden, the centrist in the party versus, you know, your uber progressive, Bernie? Isn't that what it's going to come down to?
No. See, I want to have the dialogue because I want to question those choices. I'm the uber progressive. Name a person who has gotten more progressive things done than I have. Name a governor, name a senator, name a mayor who has done more progressive things than the state of New York. You cannot.
So it sounds, Governor, like you're running for president.
No, doctor. I want to debate terminology and labels. You cannot be a progressive if you have not created progress. This is all an illusion. Well, I advocate for the perfect. Nice. That's a great ideological perspective you have. A beautiful vision. The problem we have is reality-based. And we have a Democratic Party that has talked and talked and talked and not made a difference in people's lives. That's why Donald Trump is president. He didn't win. The Democratic Party lost. We need a progressive, reality-based party. We need people who can actually get something done. You can't go back out there with great aspirations and visions of a future for all that has no credibility.
So is that a hit on Bernie?
No, it's not a hit on anybody.
Oh,
it's,
come on. I mean, I know you. I mean, I get the words. I can parse them. It sounds to me like a criticism of Bernie Sanders.
No, it's not a criticism of anyone. It's a statement about the Democratic Party. We have to be reality-based. We have to have credibility. And you know what, doctor? I can listen to your show, and you have great ideas. If you have not produced anything,
right.
As a matter of fact, you have a history of grand ideas that backfired.
Yeah, well, give me one.
Not you personally. See, everything is personal with
you.
Well,
it is. It is.
Everything is
personal. It sounded personal. It sounded personal.
No, I was you, the generic you, not the you, you.
Well, it sounded like you as in me.
No,
as
then I would have said doctor. I didn't say doctor. I said that you, the grand you, okay. I-O-U capital.
What did you think? Now that we've gotten that out of the way, and, you know, I didn't hear anything that convinced me you're not running for president. But that's okay. That's just me. But now, onto the stage at CPAC comes Donald Trump, and he hugs the American flag. What do you make of that?
Well, that's it. That is what he has been doing from day one. He has wrapped himself in the flag. He is America, American values, strong military.
He didn't go into the war. He had an ability to do that. I mean, I didn't go in, but I'm not claiming to be a military expert. He says he knows more than the generals, right? It's extraordinary. And then he wraps himself in the American flag. Some people think it was disrespectful.
Well, are you talking about reality or are we talking about politics?
Unfortunately, reality and politics can often be the same.
He knows how to market. What has Donald Trump done all his life? We're New Yorkers. We know him. He is a marketer. He did a television show. He puts his name on buildings, and then they pay him because he put his name on a building. They paid him because he put his name on an airplane. He's a marketer. He ran for president. He saw the market niche, and he played to it. He played to division. He played to fear. He did it very well. And he wants to be, he has marketed that he is the keeper of American values. The Democratic Party is now more and more removed. They're now socialists, and they call themselves socialists, which is anathema to the American dream and the American flag. I mean, he is eating this up with a spoon, what the Democratic Party is now feeding him. And he wants to make this election American values versus socialism, communism. That's what the Democratic Party represents, and that's where he's taking us.
You've been having conversations, Governor, to change the subject for a moment, with Amazon about bringing them back to New York after all. Any chance that's going to happen?
I don't believe there's a chance, but I believe my job is— as governor, you punch until you hear the bell. Now, some would say the bell sounded when they left. But look, this was really one of the dumbest governmental acts of all time, and one of the real squandered opportunities. And I'm still trying every way I can to see if there's any crack in the wall. I haven't seen one. But it was really a tragedy. It was really a tragedy. It was pure political pandering. It was fear-based. It's everything we're not. It's the formula for failure in life, fear-based. And I was thinking after our last conversation, you said the member called you up from the Senate and said, well, the governor should have rejected the Senate suggestion of generics for the PACB. What, this whole thing was a political scam? 25,000 jobs, $28 billion in revenue was a political scam? And then, by the way, the governor, if I had rejected that senator, would they come with a replacement who would support Amazon? They still haven't. They still haven't. So, I mean, it was just really one of the low points in government. And I don't care if it was done by Democrats, Republicans, zombies. It is what it is. And I'm going to tell the people of the state the truth. And I'm going to speak the truth the way I see it, whether it's about my fellow Democrats, my brother, what I would love to tell the truth about my brother and some of the comments he's made.
Wait. So now you're of course are an accomplished weatherist. I didn't say weatherman, but weatherist. You know, you watch the weather because you know, right? You know that people care more about the weather than they do about almost anything else. And we had a foot of snow in the Hudson Valley here. And I know you got out early and you warned everybody and you said you were going to do that. How important is weather to the politics of the Cuomo governorship?
It's an interesting question. It's a new dimension of the governorship. My father never did this. It wasn't really a reality in Pataki's time. Emergency management has become such a big part of being governor and having the proficiency for it. You know, anyone who says extreme weather is not a reality is just, they're not watching TV and they're not living on this planet. And then we can have a great political debate about what's causing the extreme weather, and you don't want to say it's climate change because that's inconvenient. But weather, floods, hurricanes, Hurricane Sandy, superstorms, this is a big part of the job. And it's a part that I worked on back when I was in the federal government. I did the emergency response when I was HUD secretary. I did it all around the world. But it is a very new and challenging function for the state. And I take it very seriously, Alan. You know, it's the difference between life and death. I believe that. And I say that to my team. I say when we're getting ready, if the boat doesn't show up because the trailer was broken or the truck broke down and we don't get the boat into the water and we don't have a swift water rescue team, somebody dies. And it's probably the most tangible, real function of government. You know, all this legislative stuff in the Capitol, that's nice. When you're in the middle of a hurricane, if the shelter opens up or not, if you had warning, if somebody can bring you a heater and a generator, that can be the difference between life and death. And it is a very big part of the job. And I'll tell you, it's almost on a weekly basis now.
Yeah.
Okay. Almost on a weekly basis.
Okay, very quickly now, because we've been limited to 10:25, and that gives us about 3.5 minutes, so I want to ask you quickly. I notice when you go on to make your pronouncements about the coming weather that you're dressed in a particular way. In other words, you have an open shirt and the right kind of jacket on, you know, a winter jacket. Do you have an advisor who tells you what to wear?
Yes, I have a fashion advisor. It's in the state budget. Fashion advisor to the governor. It's a titled position. That's nothing. When I was in the federal government, they would say, if you're meeting the president, they would say like storm casual.
What does that mean? Like
I don't know what it meant. It's like the storm. He's going to be in storm gear casual as opposed to storm formal. I want to know what storm formal is.
Yeah, I mean, we only have 2 minutes, but I read a biography of you quite a while ago, which made a great deal about the fact that you would go out in the middle of the night when you were a younger man and help either the AA or whoever you were working for, fix up cars, change tires, do that kind of thing. Which is harder, being governor or changing tires?
Changing tires. Changing tires is real work. Here, you just sit and talk, except in the emergencies. That is real work. And I will be up for days in those emergencies. You take even a day like yesterday. We did the weather forecast. It was especially problematic in the Hudson Valley. But I am up all night. Because that's when things happen, you know. And again, that is a new dimension to government functionality. You know, we talk about get a budget on time. That's one type of functionality. Real functionality is that operational expertise that you make things happen and that happens with efficiency and effectiveness and skill. And there's no hiding that. There's no political interpretation of whether or not the state functioned in an emergency. And that's a pure form of management to me. And you know that
politicians have suffered as a result of misplaying the carom of the weather ball. In other words, we all go back to all the way back to John V. Lindsay. I don't know if were you alive during the Lindsay administration?
No, but I read about it. That was not only did he not move the snow, but he didn't move the snow in the outer boroughs, which played into that chip on the shoulder of the outer boroughs that I still carry.
Yes, you do.
I'm from Queens. I know you see Queens as an outer borough and you
sure.
see me as a second class citizen.
Yeah, pretty much. So anyway, it is that's a joke. For all of you who can't understand sarcasm, that was a joke. It was a wonderful pleasure to have you with us, Governor, and we look forward to more conversations. Thank you so much for doing it.
Doctor, it's a problem when you have to tell people it was a joke.
I know.
Have a good day, sir.
You too.